Welcome to Book Rising, a podcast by the Radical Books Collective. Welcome, Ainehi Idoro, who is the author of Forest Imaginaries, How African Novels Think, a very gorgeous, very intriguing, exciting title. And I'm thrilled to welcome you to the Radical Books Collective book chat, book talk, and I hope lots of people tune in, because even though this is a very academic book, a very theoretical book, what it does is it really dives deep into what you're so good at, which is the understanding and knowledge of African literature. You are the founder and you still run the Brittle Paper, which, is in itself a kind of repository of incredible knowledge about African literature. You are also faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where you teach courses on African feminism, Africa and social media, African literature, African cultural studies. So we're going to pick your brains today with all of that.
Wonderful. Kind of stuff. Wonderful. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So let's start with the book, which I knew when it was in having some, there were some drafts and things like that. And now it's really turned out. It has this gorgeous cover that you were instrumental in designing. And I think you have put a whole kind of new idea, new set of discourses in motion with this particular thing. And let's just start with, so first, congratulations. And let's also start with what your book is about. I love the title, not the subtitle, that's wonderful too, Forest Imaginaries. And I love the use of the word imaginaries, which I believe is a, you know, at least in the academic sense, we use it to engage with the idea of like a set of codes or a system or a framework. And I wanted to ask you how you're using this word, if you want to unpack forest imaginaries.
Okay, very good question. The term imaginaries was something I wanted to use to signal that when I talk about the forest, I'm talking about a kind of system of related ideas. So, at the heart of the book is looking at forests as they are represented in fiction, right? So I'm not really interested in forests as they exist in real life in the world, right? Mm-hmm. I'm interested in a very kind of specific literary image, which is what do storytellers do when they use forest spaces to think about form or narrative. But then also to specifically make the claim that forests in fiction is not really a symbolic image, right? We can't say forest means one thing. You know, it represents spirituality. It represents X. It represents this, right? That I'm not so much interested in how the forest represents as I'm interested in how the forest allows us to see the way that worlds actually works in fiction. Mm-hmm. And that so imaginaries for me is doing a much more larger abstraction that lets me take this thing called a forest, generalize it, figure out its different components, and use it to diagnose, examine, piece apart the ways that worlds are built in fiction. And that term allowed me to do that so that I'm not like stuck in some kind of like symbolic or metaphorical idea of forests.
Sure. And I think the only way in which I've seen it apply before, and not only to in African literature, but generally is to think about like literature that engages with oceans in that way or water, and then the desert, which is a whole other kind thing in itself, like the desert imaginary. And then you have the subtitle, and I want everyone to understand the kind of innovative work that this book is doing. You know, you say that, you know, you kind of activate this idea of a thinking novel, you know,
say how African novels think, you know, do novels think, you know, can you say a little bit more? And then I also love this thing that you say in your introduction, you speak about Nancy Armstrong, who talks about the thinking novel at some level. And she says, if the European, and you say something like, if the European novel thinks like an individual, the African novel thinks like a world. And of course, I'm very invested in this idea of collectivity and world building. And I just wanted you to just talk about all of that.
Okay. So to start with, I'm really happy that you're thinking about the title, because I think it is very, it's very loaded. Yeah. And it took me a long time to come up with that title. And when I did, I stuck with it, even though at some point there were talks for me to kind of rethink the title. I kind of made my case that, look, this is a title that captures the eclectic work that the book is also trying to do as well. So the idea of a thinking novel, right, is, you know, built on the notion that that literary forms tell us stories, but the literary forms also generate theories about the world. The literary forms also generate theories about the world. And one of the ways that we pay attention to how stories essentially allows us to imagine worlds is to see them as machineries and as things that are essentially thinking, in the sense that it's helping us to visualize the complexities of a world. So a novel is helping us to think about space, but it's also helping us to think about particular bodies. It's also helping us to think about time. It's helping us to generate knowledge around the logics that define our world. And that if you think about it in that way, then novels are really kind of intelligent little things that are giving us the language to make worlds legible in particular ways. And this was very important to me as a kind of investment, because typically African books are read overwhelmingly anthropologically. And what I mean is that we see African fiction for how they are representative of the African world, or how they represent the African world. But I wanted to say that that's not just it. African novels are also making an argument about how worlds are made, what the logics behind the making of worlds, and that we have to be able to name that. And so the idea of an African thinking novel was trying to name that.
Yeah, there's a sort of a rehistoricizing gesture here, of course. There is a gesture to allow African literature to be more capacious and to stop making it this kind of sociological, anthropological tool, and rather to see it as this kind of rich intellectual, you know, as a sort of something with a very rich intellectual tradition, you know. And I think one of the things you draw from again and again is you draw from these foundational texts that precisely illustrate this idea. I think I don't think I'm wrong to say that your book is primarily about contemporary African literature. By contemporary, we mean like say the last 100 years or so. But for that, you draw from an indigenous forest archive, and I love this idea so much. And I just wanted you to tell us about some of these sort of foundational works that allow you to do that, that allow you to create this theory.
So I would say, you know, maybe we can start from thinking about why that type of move is absolutely necessary. And it's in part because when I started to be interested in the forest. I realized that I couldn't figure out what these images were doing as long as I kept thinking of the novel as a kind of European paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. And it showed me that a lot of what we understand about the novel is coming from its emergence as a European cultural form, right? That, so take, for instance, something as innocuous and simple as the character, right? A character is something that does very specific things in novels. And as literary theorists, we understand characters as having a particular form, right?
Sure.
But the problem is that the moment you take character as a form and you move it into African fiction, you realize that characters just begin to act very weirdly. And the only way you can explain them typically is by saying, oh, African characters are flat. They are not introspective enough. They are not, you know, they are not developed enough, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to asking, well, is it possible that what I term characters is a particular technology of narrative that does not necessarily apply to African fiction in a kind of generative and organic way? Essentially, to say that I kept getting these kind of roadblocks where my attempt to understand the forest in terms of established convention of the novel as it emerged within Europe were not helping me. So sure. I had to say, okay, can I reimagine a different genealogy for African fiction? So even though the novel was invented in Europe, the way in which it was adapted and taken up in the African context cannot mm-hmm. be defined by European terms and problems, right? Mm-hmm. So is there a way that I can reinsert the novel as a form as being generated from within an African indigenous archive? Because when African writers were writing in the 1910s, 1920s, these were writers who, they had read their Dickens, right? But they had also been kind of rooted in their own indigenous African languages and stories. So sure. The question I was asking is, look, we've always accounted for the way that Europe influenced African fiction. What we've not always been able to account for really well is, how did indigenous narrative define these forms? And the mm-hmm. forest is beautiful because it is a form that is all over indigenous storytelling. So if you want to say, how can I understand the way that forest works in African fiction? Well, don't go to Europe. Go back to, you know, Umwindo epic. Go back to Ozidi saga. Go back to Sunjata. Go back to all the many, many folk tales you've heard as a child about forests. In fact, go back to African names. Go back to African ideas. That's the archive that is going to tell you anything interesting about the ways that African writers are adapting the forest to the novel as a very particular narrative technology of modernity. That's what I think. Beginning with something like the forest completely displaces Europe as this kind of dominating genealogy for how fiction came to take form in the African space.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I remember you and I talking about when the book was, when you were still writing it, was when you say forest, do you really mean like forest with trees and, you know what I mean? Like, is it a forest? Is it spatially a forest? Or does it also extend into forest, the word, the tangle, the, you know? Greenness, you know, forests can evoke something else, you know. So
yeah, that's a very good
question.
You
really mean forest, I think. You mean forest.
I mean forest. I think that's something that I struggled with, right? One of the reviewers who responded to my book was like, what is the forest? Like, what is it? I still don't know what it is.
Well, that's an academic disease to respond like that. I'm actually asking you in your heart, where was it? But, you know, what were you in your mind, you know? Because I know you also deal with, like, you're also someone who's so into kind of social media theory and algorithm. Mm-hmm. And forest too. Like, there's forest as data and all these kinds of things. But my sense, you know, this is not the first time we've met, so my sense is that the forest was actually the forest. And then there was this cover that really clarified what a forest looked like. It's not a jungle, you know, it's a forest. And forest has a cleaner, of course, symbolic and just a general meaning than, say, a jungle, which is very problematized and, problematic and racialized and things like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to take your forest as a forest. The other thing I want to respond to is what you were saying, is that engaging with the forest becomes, in some way, allows you to develop a whole new history of African literature that, you know, that basically colonialism has disrupted, right? So so it becomes a sort of anti-colonial gesture somewhere in there. And it's, I think, the coming of colonialism, the coming of the kind of colonizing literally of our minds and bodies and all our thinking alters the sort of ways in which we receive African literature today. We haven't delinked anyway, even if it's with European publishing or American or colonial publishing or English language publishing, all of those things. But within the book, how does your, because I know you have Chinua Achebe in there, you have Felicio Inka in there, all major anti-colonial thinkers. And I just wanted to know, how does the coming of colonialism kind of shatter and disrupt this indigenous archive, this repository? And, how do you kind of engage with that?
So I would say that I try to think about colonialism as something that I wanted to bracket, or to say that there are certain tropes of colonialism that I think are not actually helpful, right? And one of them for me is this trope of break, right? That, you know, colonialism came and divided African history into two, into the pre-modern and the modern, right? So this is a trope that V.Y. Mudimbe has criticized, you know, he calls it the dichotomizing system or the paradigmatic opposition, right? And the problem with this split is that it is actually not real. It's a way that you create this split so that everything that comes after the split is defined by that split, right? Mm-hmm. So it means that, for example, when we are talking about the novel, we say the novel is the form of modernity. And then we say, you know, epics, folktale, divination, narratives, they are of pre-modern world, right? And we are not inclined to think of them in relationship to one another, because it's as if the arrival of the novel interrupted the development of these other forms. And so in order for us to explain why the African novel feels the way it feels, because we all know that African fiction feels differently, but why does it feel that way? Well, it's because, you know, it's, we will talk about it in relationship to modernism, realism, magical realism. I mean, they're just, you know, Jikandi is someone who has thought a lot about how modernism, fantasy, realism influences the novel, helps us understand the novel. I think those types of approaches are helpful, but I think they're also very much limited, because what they are not telling us is how existing forms can serve as the prehistory of the novel, right? So how is it that existing African narrative forms explain things in the African novel? Colonialism, or at least that trope of the colonial divide, prevents us from doing that.
Sure.
And it's actually not our fault, because again, if you're thinking of the novel as a modern form, then in order for you to explain the novel, you're not going to go to what has been defined as pre-modern. And so one of the big decisions I made is that I was going to bracket that divide, that claim that there is this break. And I'm going to look for, I'm going to figure out a way to use indigenous forms to explain things within the novel. Sure. And that was extremely productive, right? Because then you begin to see how it is that that many aspects of African fiction that you think, you know, it's because African fiction is some kind of like failed modernism, failed realism, failed fantasy, that how it's actually not the case. That these writers in their attempt to adapt the novel to grapple with questions, right, that they cared about, they had to literally change the form of the novel and reinvent it entirely. Yeah. So writers like Tutuola, for instance, right, that everybody just looks at in this patronizing way, you're able to literally see what Tutuola is trying to do, what he's grappling with, how he's trying to use storytelling to solve problems about form, about movement, about the body. But all those things you don't see, right?
Yeah.
Without really dipping into and starting from the indigenous archive. So yes, sure. To me, colonialism is a historical fact, but the ways that we translate it into tropes that prevent us from seeing the value of pre-modern text to me is not okay. And I wanted to kind of change that with this book.
Yeah. And you do. And I think you're also working with writers that are very wonderfully able to engage with the disruption that colonialism causes, but also never lose the continuum.
Yes.
The past, you know, and of course, Tutuola is one, Achebe is another, you know, all of them. And I think, and then you end later with Nnedi Okorafor.
Yes.
Who, you know, despite writing about the future, writing speculative fiction, still manages to keep those two things, you know.
Absolutely. And why I needed to end with Nnedi was also to show that the forest is not a kind of archaism, right? That the forest is actually a question of the future, right? Yeah. That it is a form that we can use to think about different kinds of texts in different historical moments, you know, because I was worried that people would say, well, you know, you are sort of nativizing African fiction. Why is it tied to the forest? And my point was, you know, the forest is literally, it's a narrative mechanism that allows us to think about space and disruption and revolutionary impulse. It is something that can apply to text across, you know, genres and across historical moments as well. But for me, the achievement was being able to place Umwindo epic, Ozidi saga, in the same continuum as Okorafor's science fictional text. That kind of historical genealogical work to me, the fact that I could do it made me feel like, okay, I've done my job. This is the type of opening up of history that I want to do, to say that, look, African fiction does not begin and end in the 20th century. It has a much longer genealogy.
Absolutely, 100%. And it does do all of that. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how this book came about, you know, and so the work shows a deep, deep understanding of Nigerian literature, you know, and I know, of course, that you have a deep knowledge of all African literature, but I wanted you to lean in a little bit more to your identity and your heritage as, you know, growing up in Nigeria, and tell me a little bit of what turned you onto it? Because in that sense, you know, you and I are very different, because you tend to not catch me being like, oh, here's my, all this Indian literature that I, you know. I just wanted you to kind of, you have this beautiful prologue too. I wanted you to just tell me a little bit how all this started. Little Ainehi.
Little Aina here. I love that. Girl, it's been a journey. Okay. Do you mind if I read from the prologue?
Please, I would love.
Okay, cool. Because I think that it captures everything that you're sort of prompting me to articulate. So this prologue is titled How I Found the Forest. So even though I was born in the rainforest region of Nigeria, my earliest, most memorable encounters with forests were in fiction. I grew up in Benin City, the sprawling remains of the Benin Empire, one of West Africa's greatest forest kingdoms. I am Edo, and my ancestral lands where my father and mother grew up are built up villages, though they still live under the looming shadows of the rainforest. In contrast, I grew up poor and working class in the city. On nights when there was a power outage, everywhere thickly black except for the kerosene hurricane lamp. My parents would tell stories told to them in their childhood, stories about great diviners who wielded enormous power because of the magical and medicinal knowledge gained from the forest. They would tell us stories where hunters encountered strange creatures and barely lived to tell the tale. In many of these stories, the forest was a space that was both feared and desired. It felt like where all the interesting things happened and all the cool misfits ventured. The fortunes of characters could change overnight from a chance meeting with a forest creature or a discovery of an enchanted forest object. Most of the stories came with songs and my parents would sing them. But my mother had the more beautiful voice, and in the darkness, to the ear of a child, she sounded like a siren. I was transported to what I imagined was my parents' life in the village. It was probably not their life in the village. I imagined that they encountered enchanted antelopes and mysteriously beautiful maidens in the forest. And in my child's mind, I equated my parents' experience in the village to a life of wonder in forest stories. By the time I was old enough to read children's fiction, I had come to believe that forests were synonymous with stories. Even when my siblings shoved Victorian children classics like Treasure Island down my throat, I found infinitely more pleasure reading books like The Bottled Leopard, Sugar Girl, and Koko Baboni, Nigerian novels about characters who share an intimate bond with forest. In the course of becoming a literary scholar, however, the forest receded to the background as mere setting. For most of my intellectual life, forests never stood out to me in any particular way, at least not like they did when I was a child. The forest was no different from a spaceship or a drawing room. The forest was it became just another space where characters lived out eventful lives. But all that changed when in my late 20s, rather fortuitously, I read Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart and Jojo Agamben's Homo Sucker. Simultaneously, and couldn't get the image of a sickly Unoka being left to die in the forest out of my mind. Both books ignited something that had lain dormant in my mind. The idea that forest stories captivate us because they ask very difficult questions about the world through images we can grasp. Mm-hmm. For me, it was the image of an evil forest and the many questions it led me to ask about what it meant when power took the form of deciding who lived or died. A splinter in my mind, that image drove me on a quest for other forests in African fiction and beyond. I realized that forests aren't just spaces of magic, as my childhood imagination believed. They are spaces of world making, a kind of cosmogonic laboratory where storytellers try out different ways of reconfiguring the laws that govern our worlds, so that they can offer us the knowledge of how to build a better world. When I was a child, I saw magic in forest stories. Today, I see power. Forests in stories remind me of the power we hold to make or break our worlds. I have encountered countless forests in fiction throughout the course of my study. This book is a collection of those that gripped my imagination and helped me answer burning questions about African fiction and its long history of experimentation in world building. So I think that kind of captures the way that forests, for me, helped me to see that African fiction, African storytelling has its own archive of formal and aesthetic technologies.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think because I think a lot of our viewers are hoping to also come away with some wonderful book recommendations, you know. So you mentioned, of course, oral culture, oral traditions, storytelling within family setups. And I think that's, of course, beautiful. And then you turn to print. And, of course, there's always the colonial disruption, R.L. Stevenson. Mm-hmm. Ireland. I mean, I grew up on the same thing. We were colonized by the same folks out there in the UK. So we had some of those same books that, you know, you had to wade through some of that. And I love that you talk about finally finding Chinua Achebe. You know, and Chinua Achebe is, of course, the you know, I hate using the word like the patriarch or something of literature, but he's certainly the wisest and the most canonical, the most important, you know, somebody who has given us a lot to think about. And of course, Achebe himself becoming a global figure, that's a whole other type of thing to be thought about, because some say it was actually Amos Tutuola who came before that and whose novel got published, and just different circumstances. But I think we cannot do away with the supremacy and the framework making potential of Chinua Achebe, particularly mm-hmm. things fall apart. So mm-hmm. tell me what it meant for you to read that novel and how it has changed over time. And then we'll talk about maybe yet another novel that does that for you.
So I will say, with Things Fall Apart, the biggest revelation for me mm-hmm. in thinking about the forest is that it's possible for you to read a novel and not read it. And I was surprised at how much people had read Things Fall Apart and not seen how central the evil forest was to what the novel was doing. In fact, I mean, in some ways, the evil forest is the protagonist of that novel. Mm-hmm. And I think that type of reading that allows you to let a text speak to you, I think was made possible for me using the forest to think about Things Fall Apart. But to just make it more concrete, I would say that what I love about my reading, or what I enjoyed about my reading of Things Fall Apart, is being able to kind of give an accounting of Unoka's life.
Yeah.
Because I think that it's a character that we have not honestly done justice to. Mm-hmm. And the novel itself is designed to make Unoka's life illegible. One of the most frustrating things that's kind of inspired this book in a way is that one paragraph where the narrator describes Unoka's death. It's like one mm-hmm. paragraph. And this is the same book that at the end is going to talk about, oh, you know, you have this district officer who wants to give one paragraph to Okonkwo's life. The same book, right? The same narrator assigns one tiny little paragraph to Unoka's death. He says, you know, I mean, the guy was fitted. He was ill-fitted. He was abominable. He died. Let's move on, right? Mm-hmm. But I think for me, it's saying, but this guy's death is so painful that I want you to explain to me why he was killed that way, why he died that way. And the novel, you know, resists any attempt to answer for that character's death. And that told me that if I can explain Unoka's death by who Unoka was, because the novel does not tell us who he is, then yeah. maybe I can explain it by looking at where he ended up, around. Which is the forest, right?
Yes.
And so the moment I started with the forest instead of the character, it allowed me to realize that Unoka is not the only person connected to the forest. Okonkwo is linked to the forest, right? He eventually, when he dies, his body is dumped in the forest. Sure. Obirika's twins, when they are born, they are left in the forest. Okonkwo's daughter, Ezima, as an Ogbanje, right? She's believed to have appeared many, many times. in various lives in which she's come, the dead body of the babies are dumped in the evil forest, right? All these ways in which all the primary characters are connected to this space. And what was the clincher for me was that even the British Empire is linked to the evil forest, right? In the sense that the orphanage, that sort of the church that sort of disrupted everything, that there is this space that is this underlying web that connects everybody, right? Mm-hmm. Why? What is this thing? You know, how would I read the novel differently if I set up this space as the underlying animating logic in this text? What would it allow me to do? Sure. I think reading Achebe like that opened up a whole new world to me, right? And it showed me how Okonkwo is honestly, again, I will say this, Okonkwo is not the most interesting character. It showed me how somebody like Unoka is actually way more fascinating. And that when you read through the forest, Unoka's life opens up. You realize that the tiny little paragraph dedicated to him is actually way bigger than that. And you begin to see traces of him all over the novels. I think there is a way that thinking through the forest makes Achebe's novel open up in ways that I had never seen before. And I feel very, 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 very happy and proud about the Achebe chapter in the book.
Yeah, of course. It's wonderful. You know, what you're saying reminds me also of how interested you are in archives and trying to kind of pull the sort of footnotes from the archives and blow them up, you know, which I'm, of course, a lot of people do. And I know in not a lot, not enough, but I know that you're one of the people who likes that. And I think you have been, you know, immersed a little bit. At least you've made some visits to the Amos Tutuola archive, thinking a little bit. And this is a very interesting writer that somehow doesn't end up with the same status or level of fame as Chinua Achebe, but is intriguing and interesting. And I think there's a lot more now that's being done around him, particularly the Palm Wine Drunkard, which is the book that's most well known about him. Can you say a little bit about this work, or, you know, are you working on something to do with Tutuola, or what is it about him that interests you? How do you relate to Tutuola in relation to Achebe? Because they were around the same time. They were, you know, they were peers, age-wise at least.
Yes, they were peers. And I'll say that just one detail about Tutuola, we should give everyone a sense of how we gain a lot when we move these writers into new domains that allow us to see them differently. What many people don't know about Tutuola is that he actually had a photography studio. So this is something that he dabbled into different businesses. At some point, he opened a photography studio and he was very much obsessed with photography. He would email photography companies in the UK, in America, for catalogs on cameras and radio. He was very much interested in media technology. Again, we don't tell these stories like this, right? Yeah. Tutuola becomes this kind of naive person who took folk tales and, you know, I don't know, wanted to write a novel out of folk tales and then failed badly. That's sort of this kind of way that we think about him. But this is somebody who was obsessed with media technology. And the moment you start from there, then you realize that there is that his aesthetic decisions in that novel make sense for somebody who sort of has a kind of photographic sensibility. And Tutuola has also said that He wrote his very first book, which we it's called God, I can't remember the title of this book. It was discovered much, much later and published much, much later. That he wrote that book with a colleague, with a friend, and that he would come up with the stories, the friend would come up with actual images. We don't have access to the images, I don't think, that were created. But again, that tells us that Tutuola was always thinking between narrative and visual images.
Sure.
Right? Again, this is somebody who is very imagistic in his thinking, right? That's so when we see a novel, right, that is swarming with creatures that are described with such details, such like lush details, and a story that is broken up into fragments, right? It tells us that this is not somebody who does not know how to write. This is somebody who is literally thinking in particular kinds of photographic, imagistic sensibility. And so what does it mean for us to center that knowledge in our understanding of this text, right? That is that kind of approach that I try to bring to Tutuola's text. Because again, I know that lots of people have written about him. And thankfully, Tutuola, it's becoming cool now to study Tutuola, right? Yeah. But I wanted to center that book as fundamentally a problem of a certain type of media imagination, right? Mm-hmm. And also as a text that is not random, is not chaotic. It is a very deliberately constructed text. And one of the surprising things I did was to even bring in game theory to think about the drinkers' movement through the forest. Like, what is the forest in this novel, right? And why do we have this character who keeps encountering creatures, monsters, you know, towns, and he keeps doing the same thing? He encounters something, right? They capture him, he escapes. And he repeats it over and over and over again. Why? You know, what is the kind of structural logic? Why would someone want to tell a story that is essentially an accumulation of instances where a character has to problem solve his way out of difficult, mind-boggling situations?
Again, this is my life with the ghosts or something, right?
My life in the bush of ghosts.
Exactly.
It's still structured like that, right?
Yes, it is. I know.
Yeah. And so it is this text that is essentially an archive of instances where somebody is always overreaching a limit. He gets to a limit, right? And he has to figure out a way to get beyond it, right? And so what will be the investment in accumulating, cataloging instances where a character is doing this in all kinds of different ways? What kind of epistemological imperative would make one want to build a narrative world around that problematic? The moment you begin to think like that, all of a sudden, Tutuola is not this, is this person who is brilliant, you know, in the way that he is.
But
I feel like we've not been able to name, or name in a way that is not patronizing, right? Or name in a way that is structurally rich, you know? That's sort of what I also wanted to do.
That's amazing. And I hope like that's some becomes part of like a bigger project, probably. I know maybe you're not interested in writing about a single author or something like that, but I would love to read something. You know, you could publish even a essay or something. It's beautiful what you're saying. Ainehi, you founded Brittle Paper, which is now, I'm trying to think, like, is it like 15 years old? No.
It's more than 15 years. It was 2010.
Oh my goodness. Look at that.
I know.
That's wild. So Brittle Paper is old now. It's a teenager. It's coming of age. And, you know, it's like a it's in itself a massive repository of all things African literature, contemporary, primarily contemporary African literature. And I think it's been kind of intense to see its journey, and then you all keep consistently doing this sort of work. And I just wanted to kind of ask you ways in which it somehow shaped also how this book came about, you know, because you're surrounded, you're always amplifying new writers, new books, new critics, editors, prizes, you know, all of that, the whole assemblage, you know, really, of African lit. And I just wanted to know how much of that was a really important vantage point. I mean, when I wrote my first book, running Warscapes magazine became a really important sort of, you know, was an important vantage. I just knew certain things that books didn't tell me or something. You know, I was observing a landscape in some way, and I wanted to know if Brittle Paper shaped that work doing that.
I think it does. I think it did. To start with, it made me aspire to be more legible. You know, so this is an academic book, but I felt like I wrote it as accessibly as I could, you know, given the fact that I still have to speak to an academic audience, you know. But I think Brittle Paper taught me how to write clearly and how to write in a way that showed an investment in audience, which is something that as a graduate student or as a budding literary scholar, I struggled with. So I loved it for that. I also think that Brittle Paper allowed, you know, sort of developed the kind of investment that I have in African literary knowledge, you know? That's so for me, it was not just a book about literature. It was a book that is invested in how we make African knowledge, how we make African literary knowledge, what constitutes African literary knowledge, what are the frameworks that are not working, right? Yeah. And what do we need to change to reimagine how we talk about literature? And I think when you immerse yourself in a kind of cultural sphere in the way that Brittle Paper allowed me to do, I could see that, look, this is a long game. I am invested in something that is much larger than this book is, but I'm going to try to use this book as a way to intervene in that space. You know, I'm obsessed with VY Modimbe's invention of Africa. Those kinds of thinking that is trying to articulate the blind spots of a field, you know. Sure. Are projects that I am invested in. And I think Brittle Paper allowed me to see that and understand the importance of intervening in that in a way that I don't think, if I didn't have Brittle Paper, I don't know that I would have been as militant about the fact that the way we talk about African fiction needs to change in a fundamental way.
And I think, you and I were both, you know, a group of us were around at the same time when we saw the ascendancy of African literature in the West, you know, in the West. And of course, there are all these kind of, everything is connected. And of course, we saw African publishing networks get stronger on the continent as well, you know, like basically there was a sort of a moment that kind of has carried on, and we are in a more, I would say, a settled place. I think it's not, we don't have to fight as much for African space. I mean, though, actually, I'm just thinking, like, only a couple of years ago, we were fighting about with the New York Times for the crazy.
But it's also the New York Times, though. They are very, very just stuck in some reality.
Yeah. They're not very woke, you know, is the issue at the end. And they're not global, and they're provincial. But anyway, so I think, and I know, as we are coming to the sort of end of our time today, I know that you have been invited by the African Literature Studies Association to give a keynote huge congratulations. It's much deserved.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I think, I don't know what your keynote is going to be about, but I know that these types of invitations force you to think about what is the state of, say, African literature today, or the African novel, which is very much something you care about, you know. So I want you to sort of give me a zoom out, and my favorite thing, give me a distance read, not a short read, but tell me what's out there. What do you see? Where are we headed? How do you view African literature today? Any thoughts?
So I would say that the work that folks in the speculative fiction area have done, I would say has been the most impactful in the last 15 years. I think that space has really pushed us to change the way we think about African knowledge.
Yeah.
I think if I'm thinking back to the 21st century, where we were in the 90s, in the close of the 20th century, Ben Okri wins the Booker for The Famished Road, right? Mm-hmm. Before then, African literature had sort of ceased to be the darling of the Western world, right? And all the economic crisis, all the disruption in the 70s, the 80s, that sort of had really taken its toll in an African literary industry, which in a way, I don't know that we ever had, right? So sometimes when people talk about African literary industry, they talk about it as if it started in the 50s. It's actually not true, right? Achebe was published in the UK. Much of publishing on the continent was educational publishing. Heinemann was unique in the sense that it straddled both education and a sort of kind of literary context. But the idea of an industry, right, did not exist until today. Right. So the 20th century is ending with, you know, African literature just being this thing that was not where it was in Achebe's time. Right.
Sure.
Okri's win had kind of created a new excitement around it. But when Adichie is publishing in the start of the 21st century, they were all starting from the bottom. Adichie, Habila, Chris Abani, right? But I would say that the people who really opened up African literature or literary culture, right, in a new direction, created a whole new market and domain, are the speculative fiction people. And I think that they are the future. I think they are going to, they are where I see growth happening in a way that I think literary fiction is sort of losing ground on, you know, that science fiction, speculative fiction, horror, all those people, they are going to be the future. And not just in terms of markets that they are opening, but also in the way that they really are the ones that have forced us to say African indigenous knowledges matter, you know, and that it's possible to go to that archive and re-engage it in ways that make it just make sense for us today. So I don't know. I want to give those people their flowers. And I think that if I zoomed out, to me, what they are doing, right, is going to keep growing and developing, because, darling, there is so much in African indigenous worlds and knowledges and storytelling that this is just the beginning. The more we continue to build worlds based on those archives, the more we are really going to show the world how powerful African world imagining and world building is.
That's amazing. Thank you. That's a beautiful thought to leave us with. Thank you so much for writing this book. Congratulations on all.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lots and lots of success.
Thank you.
And this conversation will be available on YouTube, and I'll put the link to buy the book and all that kind of stuff.
Wonderful. And, Thank you so much. I really appreciate you making space.
Thanks very, very much.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody.